The second case this morning, Formella v. United States Department of Labor.
May it please the Court, Peter Staswitz for Donald Formella. Congress amended the Surface Transportation Assistance Act to make it harder for employers to defend themselves against claims of wrongful termination after truck drivers like Mr. Formella make safety complaints. It's a protection for truck drivers, and since it's intended to cut down on trucking accidents, it's also a protection for the public. And Mr. Formella has been denied that protection, even though the amendments to the STA were in force at the time of the ALJ's decision in this case. Now, even so, the factual findings of the ALJ make it clear that Mr. Formella would prevail if the proper standards were applied to his case. Now, before I address why the amendments should apply, I quickly want to touch on what we do know and what's not in dispute in this case. Under either the old or new standard, we know that Mr. Formella engaged in protected activity under the STAA by refusing to drive his truck and by informing his superiors of that decision. We know he was within his rights to do so. The ALJ found that Mr. Formella had a reasonable apprehension that the mismatched tire treads on certain tires of the truck posed a serious danger to himself or the public. And we know that Mr. Formella did not have any disciplinary problems at his time at Schnitt Cartage until the day he was fired. And we know that he walked into his supervisor's office with a safety complaint, and when he walked out, he was, in fact, fired. And we also know that he was not given a reason in the letter confirming his termination for why he was fired. But when he sought unemployment, Ms. Marcus, the Schnitt employee who fired him, wrote that he was fired because he threatened several employees with bodily harm. But Ms. Marcus testified in the hearing in this case that that reason was, in fact, false. She was asked, did it have anything at all to do with the threats, it being the reason given for unemployment? She says, none whatsoever.
He had gotten a little exercised, to say the least, on that day, and it looks like it came, at least arose partly out of the attempt to talk about unionization of the drivers, right?
There is some indication that there may have been there was a union meeting, and there was in one of the confrontations with alleged confrontations with the other drivers, a union issue came up. What the ALJ found that what Mr. Formella talked about with the other drivers could not have been a proper basis for Ms. Marcus's termination. It just wasn't clear that she had any idea that he had interacted with other drivers on that day. Now the ALJ said that it was probative of his conduct, but when you look at Ms. Marcus's testimony, the person who did the firing, who didn't know what was going on, what may or may not have been going on in other parts of the truck yard, we know that she misrepresented that issue on a sworn statement, and then came back under oath and testified that there was actually no reason that she had terminated him. Now, simply put, the amendments should apply to this case because courts should apply the law that's in effect at the time they make their decision.
Well, the ALJ said that Formella was fired for, and I quote, provocative, intemperate, volatile, and antagonistic conduct. So why should we need to remand for a decision under a new standard? Doesn't that sound like the ALJ would have ruled for the employer even under the clear and convincing standard?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the ALJ also writes that if it had not been, I think the words are something like, if it had not been for the safety complaint, Mr. Formella probably may not have been fired because the firing stemmed from the safety complaint. And then that speaks directly to the heart of the amendments. The amended standard is for Mr. Formella to prove not that he was fired because of making a safety complaint, but that the safety complaint was a contributing factor. And as this circuit has held, a contributing factor is not necessarily a motivating factor. And so I think the ALJ's finding on that point already shows that the safety complaint was a contributing factor. And at that point, the burden shifts to the employer to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they would have fired him anyway. And that is a high standard. Excuse me. Some of the cases we cite show how high that standard is. There was a case we cite where the testimony of five unimpeached witnesses is not enough to overcome, was not enough to be clear and convincing. Whereas here, we're really relying on the testimony of one key witness, Ms. Marcus. And she, you know, has already been found to have misrepresented not a corollary issue, but the very issue that we're talking about here, the reason for his termination. For it to be clear and convincing, there was a case like Hassan, which we cite, where the whistleblower was dismissed because he was a temp, and everybody else who was a temp on that project was also dismissed. That's the kind of behavior that's clear and convincing, that it's something other than what the whistleblower, the protected activity was. Here we have a firing coming directly on the heels of a meeting where he walked in, the purpose was to say, that truck is not safe to drive. Here's the reasons why. And they say, well, okay, one of your reasons is fine, but the other one is no good. Go drive that truck. And minutes later, he's fired. I mean, that cases have also shown that the immediacy of the termination coming after the protected activity is an important consideration. And it's very rare for whistleblower cases to happen, for the firing to be so immediate. I think that is important in this case. Aside from the ALJ's findings about the firing stemming from the protected activity, I think the record also supports that Mr. Formella's firing was based on the safety record. And a contributing factor is really any factor which alone or in connection with other factors tends to affect the outcome of the decision. So I don't think there's any dispute from Ms. Marcus, Mr. Landowski, who was also in the office, that Mr. Formella honestly believed that that truck was unsafe to drive and that the statements he were making were all related to the truck and the safety of the truck and whether he was going to drive that truck or not. If there were union-related issues, that wasn't coming up at all in that meeting. And now, regardless of whether the clear and convincing standard or the current standard are applied, there's definitely a concept of leeway that Mr. Formella has granted, and I believe that the ALJ and the board here misapplied that concept. The test is whether Mr. Formella's behavior is defensible under the circumstances of the case. And the cases we cite provide a great comparison of what is acceptable and what isn't. The common thread that runs through those cases is that, of course, physical threats and chronic insubordination do not have to be tolerated by employers regardless of safety complaints. But the fact is that the SCA contemplates different situations than even some of these other whistleblower statutes, and the protection for refusal to drive a truck doesn't have an analog in these other statutes, so because there's this aspect of immediacy. If that truck goes out on the road, the evil that is trying to be prevented is it's too late. And it really flies in the face of, I think, human experience to expect that conversation to be 100% cordial. If Mr. Formella had a history of causing trouble in the workplace, I think that would be different. Now, if he did what the ALJ compared him to and used the example of tying a complaint to a rock and throwing it to a window or a brick and throwing it to a window, then that would be different also. But here what we have is he sat in a chair. He never got out of that chair. And stood his sat in the chair and just defended his position, it's far from being indefensible. We really should be commending him for his courage on this issue, but instead we're faulting him for it. The cases in Pogue, which we cite, there's more than one disrespectful and insubordinate meeting before the leeway is exceeded. And in that case, there were also problems with work performance and getting along with coworkers. And so that was all still within leeway in that case. And what isn't acceptable is the cases we said are pretty extreme. If you go on a drinking binge with coworkers and use racial slurs and gets you punched in the face, that's a case that we cite Combs. If you're belligerent over the course of 10 months, inappropriately touching coworkers, like that obviously does not fall within leeway. But the question really in this case is if this isn't within the leeway, if we have in a truck yard where an unsafe truck is about to go out, we have a driver who, you know, raises his voice, leans forward in his chair and says, "I'm not going to drive that truck." If that doesn't fall within the leeway, it really leaves the question, what does fall within that leeway? So with regard to either under either standard, that leeway is something that protects Mr. Formella. It's there to because we understand that in certain situations, if we've had to have Congress act on an issue, then it's obviously an issue that's serious and needs, and it's not something that can just be resolved through the day-to-day sort of activities of within the truck yard. So we need some sort of protection. So it's unreasonable to expect Mr. Formella to not, you know, become upset in some way when he's told that he has to drive an unsafe truck. But I think more importantly is the fact that the ALJ, you know, the law had been changed by the time the ALJ had reached that decision. He had, I think, 6 months before the ALJ wrote that decision, the law had been changed and was basically disregarded. And it's a protection that Mr. Formella should be entitled to, the public should be entitled to, something that makes it, pardon me, and this court would be, we asked the court to direct that verdict in Mr. Formella's favor, but an alternative, if the court remands, what would be all right, that too. All right, thank you.
Prior to your argument, good, we're going to take a brief recess, and then we'll come back and listen to your side. For a recess.
Good morning. Lauren Goodman on behalf of the U.S. Department of Labor. I'd like to begin by addressing the issue of Mr. Formella's conduct on the morning of his termination, and more specifically during the meeting that he had with Ms. Marcus and Mr. Landowski, the managers, that resulted in his termination. This court has said that conduct that is insubordinate or unreasonable is not entitled to whistleblower protection, even if it occurs in conjunction with otherwise protected whistleblower activity. And although the agency concluded that Mr. Formella did engage in protected activity during the meeting in question, the agency also found that Mr. Formella's behavior at that meeting exceeded the leeway to which he was entitled as a whistleblower under STOP. That conclusion is supported by substantial evidence in the record. I think it's important to step back and take a complete look at the facts of this case. I believe the facts, as depicted in opposing counsel's argument, were selective at best. The meeting started when Mr. Formella barged into the dispatch office using a door that the drivers aren't supposed to use in a belligerent manner, yelling about the treads on his truck and the lights on his vehicle. Once Ms. Marcus pulled Formella aside into her office, Mr. Formella's conduct continued to be belligerent, and he became even louder and more vehement. And that behavior continued for the full 20 to 30 minute duration of this meeting, even as the managers were making attempts to resolve his safety concerns. They called Penske, the truck rental company that owned the vehicle in question, to inquire about the tire tread issue that Mr. Formella had raised. They radioed out to the mechanic to ask him to immediately go and fix the lights on the vehicle that weren't working. Despite those attempts by the managers to take care and address the issues that Mr. Formella had raised, he remained outraged and angry, and in fact was so worked up that he turned red in the face and was so loud that he attracted employees to the scene from elsewhere in the facility. Notably, Mr. Formella's anger during the meeting was not directed exclusively at the safety concerns he had raised or at the manager's response to those concerns. Mr. Formella also ranted about Mr. Landowski's personality and management skills and angrily challenged the managers about the whereabouts of a CB antenna that he couldn't find. Both managers felt threatened by Mr. Formella's demeanor that day to the point that Ms. Marcus called the police at the conclusion of the meeting. There can be little doubt that Mr. Formella's conduct, yelling at managers to the point that he was red in the face, attracting other employees to the scene, and leveling a personal verbal attack on one of the managers, and causing one of the managers to feel the need to call for police. It's hard to see how that conduct is not insubordinate. And Mr. Formella repeatedly points to the fact that this was a one-time occurrence. And while that's true, I'm unaware of case law, and I don't believe Mr. Formella has cited any case law suggesting that behavior is only insubordinate if it occurs multiple times. In any event, the link between Mr. Formella's insubordinate conduct and his protected activity was tenuous at best. Although the insubordinate behavior certainly overlapped in time with the protected activity in this case, Mr. Formella's hostile conduct began well prior to the meeting in question. In our briefs, we detail the specifics of the run-ins that Mr. Formella had that morning with the two other drivers, one of whom said that when he encountered Mr. Formella that morning, Mr. Formella was, and I'm quoting, under the brink of being out of control. And the other driver said that when he encountered Mr. Formella that morning, Mr. Formella, quote, didn't sound normal, like he was in the right state of mind. In fact, Mr. Austin, one of those drivers, even said in testimony credited by the ALJ that Mr. Formella had seriously threatened to kill him because he had moved Mr. Formella's truck out of the way of another driver. The judge in this case specifically pointed to those conflicts with the other drivers as support for the fact that Mr. Formella was irate before the alleged safety problems on his vehicle had even been identified, and certainly before he took those concerns to management. So this isn't a case where an employee calmly and reasonably took safety concerns to management, only to get upset when those managers either didn't take his concerns seriously or responded in a way that could be perceived as retaliatory. That situation would be more akin to the Pogue and Hertz cases that Mr. Formella's counsel is relying on. In this case, we don't know exactly what caused Mr. Formella to get upset that morning, whether it was the anti-union meeting that had taken place or the fact that he was given a new vehicle to drive. Penske had recalled the vehicle that Mr. Formella had been used to driving, so he arrived that morning to learn that he would be driving a new vehicle, or whether it was something personal altogether, we don't know. But we do know that he did lose his cool and that it wasn't necessarily a result of the safety concerns he identified or the manager's response to those safety concerns. Next, I'd like to address the burden shifting issue and the question of which burdens of proof should apply to this case. The agency determined, using the Title VII analysis traditionally applied in stock cases, that Mr. Formella was fired because of his insubordinate conduct, not because of his protected activity. And it's important to reiterate up front that Mr. Formella has essentially conceded this finding under application of the traditional legal analysis. The sole argument he made in his opening brief on this issue was that the Administrative Review Board erred in applying the traditional legal analysis instead of the new, admittedly more complainant-friendly burdens of proof from the 2007 Staat amendments, which were passed after the trial in this case. He then goes on to argue that the outcome would be different under the new analysis. But again, he never circles back to suggest that the outcome was in error under the test that the agency did apply. Although the statute was amended approximately 9 months after the trial in this case and roughly 6 months before the judge issued his decision, Mr. Formella never brought the statutory amendments to the judge's attention. The ARB automatically reviewed the ALJ's decision in this case, and Mr. Formella filed a lengthy brief with the board, which is found in Respondent's Supplemental Appendix. But not once in that brief did Mr. Formella ever ask the agency to apply or even cite to the new burdens of proof. The agency believes this is a very clear case of waiver, and Mr. Formella's arguments to the contrary are without merit. For one, Mr. Formella's claim that his brief to the board argued the substance, if not the law, of the new burdens of proof is disingenuous at best. Mr. Formella's entire brief to the agency was written in the language of the old legal framework, including numerous references to pretext and mixed motive analyses, which were the hallmarks of the traditional Title VII analysis that the agency applied. This is not a case like the one at issue in this court's decision in FDIC v. Wright, which Mr. Formella relies on in his reply brief. In that case, the FDIC simply sought to rely on new statutory authority for an argument it had made below, relying exclusively on case law. In this case, it isn't that Mr. Formella is simply seeking to rely on new legal authority for the arguments made to the agency. He is completely changing course and suggesting that the agency erred by applying the very traditional framework that he himself urged the agency to apply in his brief. There is nothing so unique about arguments on burden of proof that they are not subject to principles of waiver. Indeed, this court's decision in Burdett v. Miller clearly stands for the propositions that parties can waive burden of proof issues by failing to raise them at the appropriate time. In Burdett, this court concluded that although the district court applied the wrong burden of proof, the defendant waived that error by failing to ask the district court to apply the correct and more demanding standard. And in that case, the district court's error was obvious. There was no question that the court had applied the wrong burden of proof. Here, there is at least a legitimate argument to be made that the amended burdens of proof do not apply to Mr. Formella's claim, particularly given that the trial was concluded before the statutory amendments were enacted. In this case, because of the way Mr. Formella handled the proceedings before the agency, essentially consenting to application of the Title VII burden-shifting framework, the agency received no briefing on the retroactivity Landgraf issues, and it shouldn't be surprising that the board did not address or resolve the question of the potential applicability of the new burdens of proof. Having not addressed the retroactivity issue in this case, the agency was not in a position to brief that issue to this court. So the court finds itself with only partial briefing on this very complex question. And
so, the Administrative Review Board did look at it, and they determined that the amendments were not relevant.
You're referring to footnote 1 in the decision.
Right.
They were referring to the 2007 Stott amendments were quite broad. They changed the remedies that were available. They changed, obviously, the burdens of proof. They changed the scope of activities that were protected by the statute. There were a whole host of changes made to the statute. And in that footnote, the agency was simply noting that those changes had been made and that they weren't relevant to the decision. And insofar as we're specifically talking about burdens of proof, I think it's reasonable to construe that footnote as suggesting it wasn't relevant to the decision because the parties had essentially consented to application of the same burdens of proof that were in effect at the time the case was tried.
And so you're saying that just that comment in that footnote doesn't allow us to review whether it was correct?
I suggest that the board did not consider the complex retroactivity question that has been raised by Mr. Formella in his brief.
And if we don't agree with your waiver argument, why shouldn't we remand this case for a determination under the current standard?
I believe that this is a case where the agency should be allowed to entertain arguments from, particularly from the employer, as to whether there are additional facts or evidence that it would present if the standards were going to be changed. The trial in this case was complete before the amendments to the statute were enacted, and the parties' expectations, thus, at the time of the trial, were that the traditional Title VII framework would apply.
So you would object to a remand? For a determination under the current standard?
For a determination on...
Right. If we don't agree with your waiver argument, I just want to make it clear what your position is. If we don't buy your waiver argument, do you object to the case being remanded for determination under the current standard?
Under the amendments?
Right.
No, we don't necessarily object to a remand if that's the position that the court is taking on the waiver argument.
Okay. Thank you.
But because the agency did not address the retroactivity issue in this case, we obviously weren't in a position to brief that issue to the court. The court finds itself with only partial briefing on this question and no input from the agency. So we don't believe it's a desirable scenario in which the court should disregard Mr. Formella's clear waiver on the burden of proof issue. In closing, it's the agency's position that substantial evidence supports the finding that Mr. Formella's insubordinate conduct was not protected under Staw, that Mr. Formella waived his arguments about applicability in the new burdens of proof, and because Mr. Formella has not challenged the agency's determination under the traditional legal analysis that applied, that Mr. Formella was fired because of his insubordinate conduct, Mr. Formella's petition for review should be denied. Unless the court has any questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How much time?
With regard to Burdett, in that case, the issue was not even raised in the appellate briefs. Here we have raised it, and contrary to what was said, I believe that the issue is relatively straightforward. The agency was on notice that it was that we were raising this issue. The only case they cite that suggests anything opposite is Woolery, an Oregon case, which is basically on a wrong law. It's based on Erie. And what is procedural under Erie versus what is procedural under Landgraf. And as far as expectations at the trial, the burdens of proof are there to guide the finder of fact. They're there for adjudication. Burdens of proof are not something that a party has a settled expectation in. In fact, this circuit has held that even a hearing itself is not something that a party, a procedural matter that a party has a settled expectation in. But I really want to address the issue of Mr. Formella's conduct, because I counted, and as in the testimony, it's very heavy on adjectives, but it's very light on what was actually done. And all this comes from the testimony of Ms. Marcus and other people who are still employed with Schnitt. And, he's barging in, he's belligerent and loud and vehement and worked up, but, you know, and he's questioning the personality, but we don't have any quotes of what he actually says. And, in fact, Ms. Marcus is asked about that, and she goes right back and says, well, it's all about trucks and competence. So it still centers on trucking and safety, and there's a lot of words put out there that make it sound after the fact that it was, well, that we felt threatened. But the only things that are actually cited that aren't to do with safety is a CB antenna, and I think that's it. There's quotes, well, he's under the brink of being out of control. And there was also the notice of a matter of Ms. Marcus calling the police, and that's true that Ms. Marcus says she calls the police. She also says, when she calls the police, that she was just told by the police dispatcher that Mr. Formella had called a minute earlier, because Mr. Formella is still on the property taking pictures of his truck to document his safety complaints.
Well, they didn't take them lightly, though. They did, during that meeting, order the mechanic, on-site mechanic to make the changes in the lights.
On the lights, right. And the lights could be fixed by the on-site mechanic. The tires couldn't be. They had to go back. They would have to send that truck back to Penske.
They did call Penske, though, and ask him.
They did call Penske. That's right. And they came back and said, well, Penske said it was fine. And it's important to remember that the ALJ found that Mr. Formello was within his rights, that he did subjectively believe, and it was reasonable, that the truck was going to be unsafe, even though he had gotten that, they had talked to Penske, that he had, you know, they had come back and said, well, Penske says it's fine. And if you look at the regulation they cite, and we put it in our brief, the way it's written, it's not necessarily, you know, crystal clear which tires need to be matched the treads, because there are certain tires that do need to have their treads matched. And so Mr. Formella did have that, you know, that issue was taken care of, but, you know, he still believed that that truck was unsafe, and the ALJ found that he was willing to try to do so. If there's no other questions...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We move to the...